This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Bush speaks in sweeping terms about the establishment of democracy and the rule of law in Iraq, but in Baghdad, plans to transfer power face a number of more immediate problems. The most recent timeline calls for the creation of a provisional government by the end of next June. Then it, in turn, would set up elections and draft a constitution. But there are a number of controversial interim steps, and ethnic, religious, and political differences are sharpening. And all of this has to be resolved amid rapid economic and cultural change in Iraq, not to mention the ongoing guerrilla war. It's going to be a long road. Just today, for example, this month's head of the Iraqi Governing Council renewed his call for a general election to choose a provisional government next year that would please powerful Shia clerics who expect to win a majority, but worry Sunnis, Kurds, and many other minorities. It's also contrary to the current U.S.-backed plan, which calls for regional caucuses to select a provisional assembly. Later in the program, we'll look at developments in several post-September the 11th prosecutions, but for most of this hour, the transfer of power in Iraq, what the players want, the issues they may be willing to negotiate, and issues of principle. If there are aspects of the process, like political parties or election structure, that you're curious about, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Adid Dawisha, a professor of political science at the University of Miami in Ohio, the author of Arab Nationalism in the 20th Century, From Triumph to Despair. He's with us from the studios of WMUB in Athens, Ohio, and it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
Can you give us an idea of what some of those interim steps that I was talking about a moment ago, what their problems are and what they are exactly and what problems may be associated with them?
Well, probably the easiest way to do it is just to go by dates. It's a kind of an agreement that has a number of processes. Each one should end in a particular date. The first important date is the end of February, where a kind of a basic law, a fundamental law, some kind of an interim constitution will be written basically by the governing council as well as the CPA. This will be a document that talks about things like Bill of Rights and federal system of Iraq and equal rights for everybody and so on. The next important date is the end of May of next year, 3 months later, where a transitional national assembly, a transitional parliament is supposed to meet, and this transitional parliament is supposed to be selected or elected through a process of caucuses in the 18 existing provinces of Iraq. This National Assembly, which is an interim parliament, will then elect an interim government by June 30th of 2004, and then the CPA's position will be finished. It will be dissolved. And now, this interim government has two important things to do. The first thing
We get to the interim government, why don't we talk about some of those interim steps?
And
the first one is the establishment of those fundamental rules of law, and there are going to be conflicts on this particular point, are there not?
Well, they're going to be the idea here is that if there are going to be any conflicts, these would be reduced by the recognition that this is only an interim constitution. It's a fundamental law that is supposed to last basically until sometime in the fall of 2005. So that whatever problems you may have with it, the important thing for people to recognize is that it is not a permanent constitution. It's a document that will expire sometime in the fall of 2005, when a new and permanent constitution will be drafted as a result of a constitutional convention that is elected popularly in Iraq.
Yet we've heard some prominent Shia clerics talk about the importance of emphasizing the role of Islam even at that stage of the process.
Yes, this is true, because they fear that any interim document might, in a sense, repeat itself in a full and permanent document later on. In other words, you set a precedent by establishing certain criteria as to how Iraq should be governed, and these criteria might, in a sense, be replicated in the permanent constitution. However, the process is very different. This interim constitution is done through the drafting by the governing council, whereas the permanent constitution is supposed to occur as a result of an elected convention by the people as a whole, who will then draft a constitution. I think the two processes are different in nature, but I can understand why the Shiite clerics are concerned about this initial document, the interim one.
The next step, the call for provisional caucuses, provincial caucuses rather, to then hold indirect elections for this transitional authority. Yeah. Again, the Shias don't want these caucuses. They want general direct elections.
Yes, they do. I presume because the caucus system, as it is envisaged, replicates the way by which the governing council has been elected, so that the CPA has a role, the governing council has a role, the local council, councils in each of the 18 provinces will have a role in choosing. And the idea here is that by doing that, you basically are diluting the influence of the Shiite community as a whole, and that's what worries the clerics.
Now, there seems to be some impatience at the same time that the Iraqis want a transfer of sovereignty as soon as possible. Of course, the United States' goal too, but a lot of people are worried that they may be doing this in too hurried a fashion, that the goal, in fact, may not be the date for Iraqi elections, but the date for American elections.
That may be the case. However, as far as the Iraqi situation is concerned, the important date is the 30th of June, when the interim government takes over, and supposedly then the CPA will dissolve. But once it is dissolved, that does not mean that the coalition forces' role in Iraq is ended. What will happen then is that the interim government will then invite the coalition forces to stay in Iraq and help Iraq on the process of democratization until the end of 2005, when there is a popular election for a new parliament and a new government. So that while administratively and probably legally the occupation of Iraq will end, nevertheless, I'll be very surprised indeed if the new government does not invite the coalition forces to stay the course until the end of 2005.
Well, joining us now here in Studio 3A is Les Campbell, Director of the Middle East Program at the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, where he currently heads their Iraq program. Thanks very much for joining us
today.
Thank
you. Nice to be here.
We've just heard from Professor Dawisha about the coalition timetable for the democratic transition. From what you've seen on the ground, you've been in and out of Iraq for some months now. How feasible do you think this is?
It's hard to say. I think on the one hand, anything's feasible if you put enough money and effort into it. You've got a lot of troops on the ground. You've actually got a lot of infrastructure that's been built up. So it's possible, but I think that the plan is already unraveling, as it were. As you mentioned at the outset of the show, Jalal Talabani, who's the current president of the, or the presiding officer of the...
I think he expired in the end of November.
He may have, the current, that's true, he just did expire. That's a monthly rotating head. But the current head is already calling into question whether or not this caucus system should go ahead, and Grand Ayatollah Sistani has definitely called that into question. And rumors on the ground are very strong that that the caucus, this envisioned series of caucuses in the 18 provinces, may not happen. There may actually be elections sooner than we thought. It's possible. One thing it's important to remember, though, is that what's possible and what's desirable may be two different things. It's perfectly understandable that the strongest political communities in Iraq, namely the Shia Muslims and the Kurds, are pushing for earlier elections because they're likely to do very well in those elections. Whether or not that's a desirable outcome is a different question. And I would argue, as a practitioner in this area of building political parties and the processes of elections, that stretching this process out to the envisioned time of the end of 2005, in terms of the long-term prospects of democracy, would be better. A lot of work needs to be done to sort of level the playing field and get people that are currently marginalized, some of the Sunni Iraqis, some of the urban educated professionals who don't have a party structure to jump into, they need some time to get into the political debate.
Let's get some callers involved. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Pat, who joins us from River Falls, Wisconsin.
Yes, I just wanted to remind people that this is a country that produced Saddam Hussein. Our military has liberated them and given them an opportunity for freedom. I think the priority should be to possibly the Iraqi oil reserves paying back for the war and keeping these guerrillas from coming in from all over. So I think our priority should be maybe not, since we've already freed the Iraqi people, but that we should repay the military expenses of the U.S. that have given them this opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Pat. Professor DeWisha?
I think it's very important for us to realize that this is an unfinished business. It would be really a tragedy if we were to basically focus on what Iraq's debt is to us or to anybody else, or the international community. I think it's important to recognize that what the end result in Iraq is going to have a profound impact, not just on the country itself, but on the region, and I presume on our vital interests, national interests in the long term. So to have the commitment to stay the course and not to leave until a sustainable and functioning democratic system is established in Iraq would be a great folly. We really need to stay the course.
Les Campbell, one thing that many observers have pointed out is that the reason the United States has called for indirect elections as an interim measure is to allow some breathing space for things like political parties and institutions to develop, as opposed to fears that in the instant election, the best organized groups would be the Ba'ath Party and some Islamists who might reap rewards from early elections.
Right. In fact, I would the caller's point, of course, is a valid one, but I would also remind him that the U.S. did get rid of a dictator, but it wouldn't be much good to replace one dictator with another or some kind of collective dictatorship. So it is crucial to look at things like building institutions, building the capacity of the governing council, putting together elections in a way that leads to an outcome that's reasonable, but also giving ordinary Iraqis who desperately want to have a role in the decisions that affect their lives, a chance for them to get involved in these decisions in the next couple of years is crucial.
Professor DeWisha, we welcomed you on the program, and I wanted to ask you, in your appearances on this show before the war began, you wrote very positively about your chances for a democratic Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Well, now, several months after the fall of Saddam, what do you think? Are you still just as hopeful?
Yes, I think I'm just as hopeful. We don't get a lot of reports about what's happening outside the area where we're having a lot of trouble, which is basically the Sunni area, which is now popularly known as the Sunni Triangle. But a lot of things are happening outside that triangle, either in the north or in the south of Iraq. Many of these local councils have been elected. Some of them have been elected through grassroots democracy. In fact, what is interesting to me is that when I even watch hostile Arab satellite stations like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, when they ask Iraqis, what surprises me is the kind of the discourse and the language of politics, where words like elections, parliament, constitution, human rights, and so on are constantly being voiced by ordinary Iraqis. And it seems to me, therefore, that the whole kind of culture of democracy is growing in Iraq beyond the institutional designs that we continue to think about. So simply from that point of view, I think that democracy certainly can be built in Iraq and it can be sustained. But I agree with Mr. Campbell. We really need to have time. We need to have, for example, an associational law to see which parties can be formed, what are the conditions for forming a party, who can and who cannot be members of party, and allow these parties to set up programs and communicate them to the people before we can have an election.
Professor DeWisha, thanks as always for being with us today.
Thank you.
Professor DeWisha of Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. I misspoke earlier. We'll have more on this point after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the road to an independent Iraq with Les Campbell, director of the National Democratic Institute's Iraq program, and we're taking your questions. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Norman, who joins us on the line from Seattle, Washington.
Yes, good morning. My question is, never in the history of the United States has U.S. government ever directly intervened with its military or CIA in the non-European developing third world for the direct purposes of establishing a democracy. Quite to the contrary, the U.S. government has subverted or overthrown democracies and even assassinated democratic leaders all over the third world, even in the Middle East, as in Iran, while supporting or installing dictators, including once, of course, Saddam Hussein. So my question is that what will be the strict timetable for the U.S. progression to democracy in Iraq, a strict timetable that would give the Iraqi people the confidence to believe that at least this time we supposedly mean what we say, as opposed to installing a government that will do what we say? Thank you.
Thanks, Norman. Les Campbell, I don't know if you want to get involved with the preamble there, but what about the timetable question?
Well, what I actually like to say is that I think we all have to be able to look beyond agreements or disagreements with U.S. policy in this question. The fact is that Iraqi people are now in a position where someone's got to step in and build institutions and bring democracy. It's crucial. I've dealt with many, many Iraqis whose aspirations are very much in that direction. They want to join the modern world, and I think it's important for all of us to step into that. The timetable is outlined recently by the CPA, which Professor Dawisha mentioned, I think is pretty strict. In fact, it's very it's optimistic. If anything, it may not happen in that time frame. But a new interim government, Iraqi sovereignty by June of 2004, followed by a constitutional process, followed by national general elections by the end of 2005. That is a timetable that Iraqis, I think, can live with. I think if the U.S. lives up to its obligations, which I think it will, Iraq may become one of the first Middle East countries to have a reasonably functioning democracy, and I'm optimistic that can happen in that time frame.
A critical issue, though, will be legitimacy, particularly of the provisional and then the eventual regular government, and a persistent thorn in the side of American authorities on this exact point has been the Shiite cleric Ayatollah Ali Sistani. In recent weeks, he's called for a general election. He says that is the only way to establish any form of legitimacy for a provisional government, and he's also spoken about the importance of the role for Islam in any new government. Joining us now to talk about Sistani and the role of religious Shiites in general is Professor Juan Cole. He teaches history at the University of Michigan. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam, and he's with us from the waiting area in the Detroit Metro Airport, and thanks very much for being with us on your layover.
Thanks for having me.
Who is Ayatollah Sistani, and how does he see his role in this process?
Ayatollah Sistani is the leading Shiite jurist in Iraq, based in Najaf. He came to Najaf in 1952 from Iran and rose in the hierarchy there, which one does by demonstrating erudition and learning and attracting a popular following. So there's a sense in which he both has the blessing of his fellow clerics in the Shiite hierarchy and also is enormously popular with the common people.
And how broad is his base of support?
I think virtually every Shiite in Iraq would say, if you asked them, you know, whose religious rulings do you tend to follow, they would mostly say Sistani.
Now, it's curious that he first issued his ruling, his fatwa, last June, and it took a while for people to understand, A, that I guess he meant it, and B, that everybody else was going to be following his lead.
Yes, initially when he issued that ruling that any constitutional committee that would draft a new constitution must be elected from the body politic, the American administrator, Paul Bremer, and other American officials initially dismissed the ruling as impractical and attempted to actively to find ways around it. And we're unable to because the Shiite majority on the interim governing council that Mr. Bremer had appointed stood with Sistani to a person on this issue.
The other big issue, of course, is a division between state and mosque, if that's going to be in the rule of law, the basic rules that would be drawn up before a constitution. And that's another point on which the Ayatollah Sistani has been adamant.
Absolutely. Sistani wants an undertaking that it will be in the Iraqi constitution and in any basic law that's formulated that Iraq is an Islamic nation, And he wants an undertaking that the Iraqi government will not legislate or initiate policy directly contrary to Islamic law.
We have an email question on this from Kurt in Renton, Washington. Do the Shiites grasp the concept of a government in which no religious group dominates and under which all religions are protected, or is there an us or them mentality?
Well, they don't see it in the same terms. That is to say, if you press them on this issue of minority rights, they say, well, yes, we'll give the minorities their rights. They can practice their religion. They can do as they like. It's simply that the national law is going to be framed with primary reference to Islamic law. And in traditional Islam, it should be remembered that in the medieval period, Islam was probably the most tolerant of the world religions. It made a formal place for non-Muslims in society to practice their religions. So I think the idea of having a civil law that applies to everyone equally is not so common in the Middle East. It exists in Turkey and to some extent in Tunisia. But in most places, accommodation is made to religious traditions.
Before they call your flight, Professor, I wanted to ask you about, you were speaking that almost all Shias would follow Ayatollah Sistani. We also hear about a division between religious Shias and secular Shias. Is that a significant split?
I don't believe so on this particular issue. That is to say, there are undoubtedly large numbers of secular Shiites in Iraq, but they are secular in the sense that they don't want a particularly religious government. They might like to have Western movies playing in cinemas and so forth. But if you ask them on matters of religious principle, which rulings would you honor most, they would still say Sistani.
Professor Cole, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Juan Cole is the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan, and he spoke with us from the airport in Detroit. And let's get another caller in. And this is John, and John's on the line with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, recently I understand there was a trial balloon floated about potentially splitting the state of Iraq into the Kurdish North, the Sunni Central, and the Shia South, and I was wondering whether you've heard of any international kind of comment on that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks very much for the call, John. Les Campbell?
Well, that has been floated, and there has been a lot of international commentary, most of it negative, saying that a three-region Iraq is a recipe for breaking the country up. I think that most people recognize that some type of federalism will be important in Iraq. It's a country that will need to be decentralized. But most people that have looked at the question are looking at the current 18 provinces and looking at what kind of decentralization of power can be given to those provinces, because then the populations of the 18 regions won't be exclusively one sect or another.
Obviously, the issue of regional autonomy is crucial for the Kurds of northern Iraq. We're going to joining us now to talk about where the Kurds stand in the struggle to shape Iraq's future is Henri Barki, chair of the International Relations Department at Lehigh University, and he joins us from his office at the school in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Recently, as you've just heard, we've been talking about Shiite demands on the political process. Where are the Kurds right now?
Well, the Kurds are, when you look at all of Iraq, the Kurds are the one group that does not feel Iraqi in the traditional sense of Iraqiness, which means being mostly an Arab. Whether you're a Sunni Arab or a Shia Arab, you tend to look at yourself as, you identify yourself as an Iraqi. The Kurds have had this difficult relationship with the central government in Iraq, and they have been persecuted. They have tried to secede. They have made alliances with other states in order to achieve that. So they are going to stay within Iraq so long as their special circumstances are recognized. And by that they mean a great deal of autonomy for the region in the north, so that they will not be dominated by the center as they had been in the past. But that's also means in many Kurdish minds the city of Kirkuk will become theirs, and with that, a great deal of the oil resources to be shared with the rest of Iraq. But nonetheless, they want to have some say into their own finances, their own education system, their own politics, and they will also not accept a constitution that makes Islam a very strong part or center stage. In other words, while many all Kurds are Muslim, they still see themselves as much more secular, and they would not want to see a religious state in any shape or form.
Much of the northern part of Iraq, which the Kurds call Kurdistan, has been autonomous, not under the control of Saddam Hussein, since the end of the first Gulf War in 1991. And the Kurds, though they've had their difficulties between the two big Kurdish parties there, have established a functioning, organized government there. In a sense, they're ready to go their own way, aren't they?
Well, in fact, they've established two functioning governments because of also two different parties in the north. And in many respects, and ironically, I would add, having two separate governments has actually worked very well for them because there's been a great deal of competition between the two governments to be able to show to their individual populations that they can provide services. And despite the fact that at the beginning, or let's say the first 5 years after the Gulf War, between 1991 and 1996, the conditions in the north were pretty horrible, things have got better after 1996 when the United Nations allowed Iraq to sell oil on the international market, and the Kurds got 13% of all the resources allocated to Iraq. So not only they had their own political system, but for the first time they had significant resources flowing into their region. And what they did, and which is very interesting, is that not only they created political institutions, but they also overhauled their civic institutions. So you have a great deal of I wouldn't necessarily call it complete democracy, but the birth of civil society, even before Saddam's overthrow this year in Soleimania, you could buy any newspaper you wanted, including Kurdish newspapers that had been printed in Baghdad by Saddam's people propagating Saddam's ideology. And the Kurds were perfectly fine allowing their citizens to have access to them. So they, for the last 10 years, they've had this amazing amount of freedom, which also makes it very difficult for them to accept a return to a centralized Baghdad-run government. I heard one of your callers asked about the splitting up of Iraq. I don't think this is really in the cards. I mean, it would be too much too messy because all you have to do is look at the city of Baghdad, which has 1 million, 2 million Shia, that hundreds of thousands of Kurds, Turkomans, in addition to the Sunnis. So it's not there's not a clean way of splitting Iraq up. Having said this, if there was no federation created in Iraq, it is quite conceivable that the Iraqi Kurds would try to bolt and create their own state. That would be still very difficult, but that's a possibility.
And that, of course, would run into concerns of Syria, Iran, and Turkey, all of which have very sizable Kurdish minorities of their own. But that's another issue for another day. Professor Barkey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Henri Barkey is a former policy planner at the State Department. He currently chairs the International Relations Department at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. We reached him at his office there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get to another caller. This is Yasef, who joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, how you doing, Neil? How are you?
Very well, thank you.
You know, I am just concerned about the Shi'at in Iraq. If Sistani doesn't get along with the councils and doesn't get along with Paul Bremer, he may just tell his people to go ahead and declare jihad against these people and join the Sunni, and it will be a big problem. Because you can't ignore the Shi'at. They are 60%. And if you do give the Shi'ar everything, and you give it to the Sistani, you will have another Iran government, which is the United States doesn't like.
Les Campbell, I think he's put it in a nutshell, and that's kind of the dilemma.
It is a dilemma.
Yeah, if you ignore the Sunnis, you get also the Sunnis, the Kurds are Sunnis, the Turkmen are Sunnis, and they get together and fight again.
Yosef, why don't we deal with one intractable problem at a time?
Well, I think that the point the caller brings up is almost the nub of the question of democracy in Iraq. And but just to say one thing, I don't know if it's the case that Ayatollah Sistani doesn't get along or there's a conflict between him and Paul Bremer and the administration. In fact, they're allied and they work together well. And, you know, just even going back to a previous question, it's not clear that Shiites in Iraq want a government run by clerics. They want a government that gives a nod to Islamic principles, but I'm not sure they want clerics, even Sistani, who's very respected, I'm not sure they want him running the government.
What about Islamic law, Sharia?
Well, you know, the question becomes how much respect do you give Islamic law? To kind of put it in a nutshell, does Sharia law, is it the source of legislation or is it a source of legislation? And I think that the versus a question can be negotiated even with Sistani. But the question of bringing all the people who are on the outside in and bringing all the pieces of Iraq, geographic, sect, confession, ethnic group, bringing them into a system where they feel that there's something for them. There's a reward for getting involved. That, to me, is the nub of the question. How do you build parties and institutions over the next 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, and then 24 months that allow, you know, almost all Iraqis, some are never going to agree, but almost all Iraqis to feel that they're part of what's being built?
Email question from Steve Jones in Scottsdale, Arizona. Democracy is built from the ground up. He writes, in Iraq, we are trying to impose a government from the top down. Whatever we build, it won't be democratic until there are free and fair elections. We should have started early on to build democratically elected councils at the village and city level, then worked upwards to provincial and then national government. Is any of that going on, or is that a fair comment?
Well, that is going on. In fact, there are local councils. They start at the neighborhood level, go to the city, and then to the regional city level. I'm not sure if it's quite right that you build from the ground up. I understand the sentiment there. I think it's true that it has to be an indigenous process. But there are no actual examples of functioning local government systems in the Arab world. Every single Arab country is run from the center. And so it would be a little difficult to start in Iraq with a system that no one's familiar with. So in some ways, national elections have to be the centerpiece or the linchpin of the rest of the democratic process. But there are local councils, and in many cases, they're functioning pretty well.
And your overall, you say this is doable. I guess the wild card in all of this is the extent of the resistance in central Iraq.
It's doable. The question is, can you go out and register people as voters? Can you build political parties? Can you start polling centers? Can you have local councils meeting in the midst of fighting and insecurity? Is it doable from a physical sense? In other words, people's safeties, Iraqis and foreigners, but even in a psychological sense, will people concentrate enough on these, you know, somewhat esoteric issues of representation and democracy at the same time that they're worried about gunfire and bombs?
Les Campbell, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Les Campbell directs the Middle East program at the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. He returns to Iraq tomorrow to work on their program. Today, he was with us here in Studio 3A. We appreciate that.